Today on Maine Calling, U.S. Senator Angus King takes your questions. From the situation in Ukraine to what's known as the torture report to the NSA's collection of personal phone data, Maine's two senators are at the center of policy debates on a long list of major issues. Republican Susan Collins and Independent Angus King occupy two of the 15 seats on the Senate Intelligence Committee. And today we'll talk with Senator King about these matters and other topics of national interest, including the latest developments in the implementation of the Affordable Care Act. We also want to hear from you wherever you happen to live in the state. It's your chance to talk directly with one of your elected representatives in Washington. Independent U.S. Senator Angus King, our guest today on Maine Calling. First, this news. From the MPBN studios, I'm Keith Shortall, and this is Maine Calling. There's no shortage of news coming out of our nation's capital these days. Yesterday, the Obama administration announced that it will give additional time for those who had tried to apply for health care under the Affordable Care Act but were blocked by technical problems with the federal exchange. The Senate's expected to vote on aid to Ukraine any day now, and President Obama announced plans to overhaul how the National Security Agency collects and maintains bulk telephone records. Joining us from the Senate radio studio in the Capitol building to talk about all of the above and more will be Angus King, the junior senator from Maine. We invite you to join our conversation. Phone number 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. And as often is the case, as we mentioned, there's a lot of activity going on in Washington, including some key votes. And so our guest for the hour, Senator King, is actually carrying out those votes. And in his stead, we have Senator King's chief of staff, Kay Rand, filling in. Hi, Kay. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Keith. It's great to be here.
So you were kind of...
I know how disappointed your listeners are.
Oh, no.
I've faced it before.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure we just appreciate you jumping into the seat there while your boss is doing business. What exactly is the senator voting on at this hour?
They just opened the fourth vote, so he shouldn't be much longer. They're voting on four district court judges from other parts of the country. Right now, a judge from Pennsylvania. We're excited to see these list of judges get ticked off because our own John Levy will be up hopefully within the next 30 to 60 days as we go down this list of judges.
You know, and there's been obviously a lot of coverage of the frustration about the delays in processing a lot of judges. Is this an example of some much awaited movement?
Well, what we're voting on, Keith, is to invoke cloture. So first we, without cooperation from both sides, we invoke cloture, and then some time has to elapse for debate time before we can actually vote on the judges. So it's still taking a little more time. Cooperation is a wonderful thing in the Senate. Lots of things can happen with cooperation. Absent cooperation, it takes a lot more time.
Sure. I thought we would follow up with a question about that one of our listeners had the senator didn't feel prepared, I guess, to answer at the time, and so we'll pick up there. And it was a question about something called the Children and Families First Act, and the caller had asked the senator to support this act, which he said he'd look into. What is the Children and Families First Act, and what does it do?
It was actually Jenny from South Portland.
Keith, oh, wow, you know. Okay.
I do. Remember, it's a bill that streamlines adoptions that happen between countries. Senator didn't know anything about it. After the phone call, we looked into it, and he did become a co-sponsor of the bill. But more importantly, armed with the information from a constituent in Maine when he had the opportunity to talk to Secretary Kerry at the Secretary, who's Secretary of State. He actually had an occasion to advance the idea a little bit by talking to Secretary Kerry. And somebody just left the Senate floor and is now in the studio.
Oh, okay. We have...
Hi, Keith.
Hi, Senator King. How are you?
I'm fine, but I don't want to mess up Kay's. I'm sure she's doing much better than I would.
She's doing a really good job.
It's perfect timing.
Yeah, if you could just wait a while, Senator King, we'll keep talking to Kay. No, actually, if you would jump in.
Kay.
Bye, Keith.
Kay, thank you, Kay, for filling in so
You're
ably.
Welcome.
Yeah, thank you. Senator.
I apologize, Keith. One of the realities of the world down here is that you're not the master of your own schedule.
Well, indeed. And and this is evidence that the Senate is getting things done, right? You were having a...
Yeah, we just had four votes in a row and came out of an Armed Services Committee hearing and going back into Armed Services this afternoon. So, but here I am.
All right. Perfect. Well,
what do you got for me?
Oh, not much. But welcome to the program, first of all, and I'll let you catch your breath. We want to talk about a few things, if we can, around your work on the Senate Intelligence Committee, and we'll get to that. But an item ran as an urgent a few minutes ago across the AP wire about an agreement that leaders have reached on legislation to forestall the 24% cut in Medicare payments to doctors, the so-called doc fix, which comes up every year, I guess, under this scenario, and then is kind of put off and given a fix with promises to fix the long-term solution. And I'm wondering, you know, the perception of this is in these cases that, particularly with entitlements, that Congress does this a lot, that they sort of forestall an emergency, or with budgets, they forestall the emergency and kind of kick the can down the road. Is that a fair assessment, or are these isolated examples?
Well, I mean, there's no question that all of us avoid hard decisions. I don't know about you, but I never did my book report until Sunday night. That was due on Monday morning. But the reality is these are hard decisions, and I think it's fair. It's a fair criticism that they're put off. I mean, the doc fix, the Medicare physician reimbursement, has been going on, as you say, every year since the late 90s. Senator Rockefeller and I actually proposed a one-time fix that was fully funded that would take care of this problem once and for all. But when I explain it, you'll understand why it hasn't been passed. When they passed the drug benefit, remember under President Bush, the Medicare drug benefit, the law prohibited Medicare from negotiating for drug discounts on behalf of the people that were beneficiaries, some of whom are what are called dual eligibles, people that are eligible for both Medicaid and Medicare. That cost the government $140 billion over 10 years, and that's a solution. If we just went back to the way the law was before that drug benefit was passed, wouldn't affect beneficiaries whatsoever, wouldn't affect doctors. It would fund the doc fix. It would basically only affect the pharmaceutical companies, which didn't have to give the discounts that they give to Medicaid and the VA. So, but you're right. I mean, we do tend to avoid the difficult decisions, and it's one of the frustrating things about this place. I'm hoping to be able to nudge things in a different direction.
All right, let's go to some of the front and center questions, particularly around world affairs and intelligence issues that are happening in Washington and around the globe right now. To Ukraine, what can or should the U.S. do about Russia's actions regarding Ukraine?
Well, first, I think the first answer is to be very careful. This winter, I just finished reading again the book The Guns of August, which is the story of how the world stumbled into World War I, and it's a very cautionary tale about how miscalculation and alliances and people not fully realizing the consequences can get you into catastrophic situations. So the one thing we have to do is to be very careful and measured in our response. The second point is, to be honest, and I think everybody realizes this here, we don't have any real military options. This is a part of the world that is literally on Russia's border. It's where their army is stationed nearby. So this, it really has to be a question of sanctions and what is it that will deter the Russians from this kind of aggressive action. One of the real questions is this Putin enforcing a kind of Monroe Doctrine right on his border, or is he saying we're going to reestablish the Soviet Empire and we're going to start with the Ukraine and then we're going to look at Moldova and Latvia and Belarus and the other countries that are particularly to the west of Russia toward Europe? And that's an open question right now. I don't think anybody knows the answer to that, and I'm not sure Putin even knows it. My sense is that a lot of this is ad hoc policy being made in Moscow based upon the ouster of their ally as the president of the Ukraine. In the long run, one of the most important things that could happen is to lessen Europe's dependency on Russian gas. It's very hard for the Europeans to be tough with the Russians when, for example, Germany gets 50% of their natural gas from Russia. That is a dangerous geopolitical reality. And to the extent they can find alternatives, develop alternative sources of energy in the long run, that would be a big deal for Russia because something like 50% of their governmental revenues come from oil and gas. But in the meantime, I think it's got to be sanctions. It's got to be international exclusion because Russia does want to be a player on the world stage. And we've got to be sure that they don't feel that there's going to be no penalty to be paid if indeed they go into eastern Ukraine.
We've heard some analysis from people who study Russian history closely who say that Putin is really only interested in solidifying his position, his strength within certain elements of the oligarchy. This is action meant to solidify his position internally, and that he really doesn't have much concern about how people outside of that sphere care about him internationally. If that's the case, does that inform the U.S. position with respect to Ukraine and their concerns about expanding?
Well, certainly everybody's trying to understand what his motivations are and whether it's internal, external, whether it's rebuilding. He has been quoted as saying that he thought it was a historic mistake when the Soviet Union broke up and sort of speaking wistfully of the Soviet Empire. So there is that, and clearly he has visions of a greater Russia. And that's been a historic reality. So, you know, everybody around here is trying to read his mind. I don't know that anybody has, deep insight. As I say, one of the best analysis I had read was that this wasn't a long-considered, deeply planned strategy, but that when the pro-Russian president of the Ukraine essentially fled the country— it created a situation they felt they had to react to. And then the Crimea, of course, is a different situation because the Crimea was part of Russia until 1954 when Khrushchev essentially gave it to the Ukraine. And the Crimea is a very important part, a very important geographic place for Russia because it's their only warm water port. And so the Crimea is sort of a separate case. I think the real question is going to be what's going to happen with those Russian troops that are now doing exercises on the eastern Ukraine border. And it's complicated, of course, by the fact that there are lots of ethnic Russians and people that speak Russian in the Ukraine. This is very dangerous territory, and it's easy to say, well, he's just trying to, you know, do the normal sphere of influence of Russia. On the other hand, it's eerily reminiscent of the reasoning that Hitler put forward for invading the Sudetenland at the beginning of World War II, saying we're just going to protect the ethnic Germans and German speakers. And, of course, what followed was 55 million dead. So that's why I say my first comment is this is a case where we have to be very careful, very measured, and be very clear about what we're doing and why, so that there aren't misunderstandings. Because, again, if you look at history, many great conflicts have begun essentially from misunderstandings and one country not overreacting to something that they perceived as a mortal threat, which really wasn't. So it's just one of those cases where you don't envy the President of the United States. He's got to make some very, very difficult decisions.
All right, we've got a lot more to get to. I want to talk also about this feud, if you'll call it that. Others call it a constitutional crisis, depending on your point of view, between what's happening between the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence and the CIA. Lots to get to there. But we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we also want to hear from you. The number, 1-800-399-3566, to join the conversation. That's 800-399-3566. Our guest today, Senator Angus King. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Maine Calling is made possible by listeners like you and by Maine Health, working with member hospitals like Maine Medical Center to help make our communities the healthiest in America, MaineHealth.org. And by Libby O'Brien Kingsley and Champion, a law firm serving individuals and businesses in Maine, Massachusetts, and New Hampshire, LOKLLC.com.
On the next Fresh Air, Karen Russell, author of the bestseller Swamplandia, talks about her new novella, Sleep Donation. It's set in the near future during an insomnia epidemic. Russell imagines an America where new insomniacs are forced to file for dream bankruptcy and wait to be approved for sleep donors. Join us.
Join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7.
Hi, this is Erwin Gratz, host of MPBN's Morning Edition, the news program many of you wake up to. As you know, listener contributions are what makes Morning Edition and this entire public radio service possible. And we know many of you also value the way we now take care of business. Instead of the usual week-long or longer membership campaign, we're now doing it all in one day. Let's keep this amazing way we do business alive and well. Please support your public radio station on Super Thursday, April 3rd, just one day. And thanks.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Our guest on today's program, Senator Angus King. We invite you to join the conversation. The number, 1-800-399-3566. That's 800-399-3566. Email talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. As I mentioned before the break, Senator, we had a listener who writes, I'm deeply concerned about the unwillingness of the CIA to cooperate with the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, on which both you and Senator Collins serve. Last night, I read Chairperson Senator Feinstein's speech presented to the Senate on March 13th. I'm appalled because it appears to her, at least, that the constitutional balance of powers is in jeopardy. And since it's the committee's job to oversee the CIA, this listener, and I think many others are wondering whether, is this a true standoff? Is the CIA cooperating to the extent that you'd like? Is there an issue there that needs to be addressed?
Well, there's certainly an issue that needs to be addressed, but I think it needs to be put into context that when this study started, which was before my time in the Senate and on the committee, it started actually, I think, 5 or 6 years ago. There was a huge amount of data turned over by the CIA, something like 6 million pages of data. So it's not as if they've been stonewalling and saying, we're not going to produce data. They produced a great deal of data. This recent flare-up really comes at the end of the process. The committee, the report actually has already been accepted by the committee, again, last December before I came. And now we're going to have a vote in the next couple of weeks on declassifying the report, which is essentially releasing it to the public. And I'm insisting, in fact, I just met with Chairman Feinstein on the Senate floor during that vote. I want to see the final modifications to the report, and I want to see the CIA's final comments before deciding how to vote on that report. It's very important, and I want to be sure we do it right. On the question of this problem, I'm a little reluctant to talk too much about it because it is within the confines of the committee, although the chairman has gone to the floor and talked about it, so I can certainly go in that go by what she said. The dispute is that it appears that the CIA went into the computer system of the committee of the Senate to see whether the committee had certain documents that the CIA didn't think had been were properly in our possession. And the issue that raises, as the reader, as the listener says, is an issue of separation of powers, and you know, the CIA using its abilities to essentially tap into a congressional committee's computer network. If that's true, it's a very, very serious matter that I can assure you is being viewed most solemnly around here. The current status is that the matter has been referred to the Department of Justice for criminal investigation. We have also here in the Senate referred the computer questions to the Sergeant at Arms, which has some very high level of computer forensic ability, just to get to the bottom of what actually happened. And I'm always reluctant to decide cases before I'm sure of the facts. But if it is the case that the CIA went into the network of the Senate committee without knowledge or permission, that's a very serious offense that for which I think you will see there will be serious consequences.
Let's try to bring in some calls now to South Portland and Don. Hi, Don. Welcome to Maine Calling.
Hi. Thanks for having me on, and we want to say what an honor it is to be able to speak with our most illustrious senator. And
Hey, Don, usually when I get a buildup like that, I'm about to get zinged.
Oh no, never would never happen. It sounds like maybe the wind on the Senate floor is blowing as hard as it is up here in Maine today.
Well, I heard this morning you guys are going to have a serious blizzard this afternoon, especially down east.
Yep, they're going to get it up here in Washington County. Anyway, we've met a couple of times. I've been an activist since Vietnam. You know, I'm very upset, as a lot of Americans are, and what, you know, the Obama administration, you know, touted his administration as was going to be the most transparent administration in history. I kind of think he's got a pass because he's a Democrat and a progressive. But to me, his administration has single-handedly, with Congress kind of standing by, systematically dismantled the Constitution with a war on whistleblowers, extrajudicial killings with drones, and warrantless wiretapping of individuals, governments, and whole nations. Two questions for you. One, do you think that Edward Snowden, who a lot of this information we would have never known if he hadn't come out and blown the whistle, should be granted clemency? And two, are you for metadata collection? Thank you so much, sir.
Absolutely. Let me take them one at a time. I do not think Snowden should be granted clemency. I know there are a lot of people that think he's a whistleblower or a hero of some kind. I don't agree. He stole, we now think it's about a million pages of documents. If you're a whistleblower and are concerned about process and what's being done, you don't have to steal documents and go to Russia. That you can go to the press here in the U.S. You can say, I'm concerned about what's happening. But he took information that could be severely damaging to our country's interests. And we don't know what he's given to the Russians. Of course, the first place he went was China. So I'm all for whistleblowers, and I'm all for people that that raise these kinds of issues. But there were ways he could have done it without taking a massive amount of information with him that really doesn't have anything to do with national security policy, but has to do with with some information that could compromise the security of the country. And the other piece is, and I'll say that, you know, on the Intelligence Committee it's a very solemn responsibility because nobody else is watching these folks, and I take that very seriously. But there are two sides to this question. The Constitution in the preamble says the fundamental purpose or a fundamental purpose of the country is to provide for the common defense and ensure domestic tranquility. And, of course, the Fourth Amendment then says the people have a right to be secure in their persons and papers against unreasonable searches and seizures. That's a tension that's built into our Constitution. But we have to remember that there are real people out there who are really plotting to really kill us. We may not want to hear that. We may not want to think about it, but that's a fact. And I view this this question of Snowden and the NSA and the data we're constantly trying to find the right balance between protecting privacy, protecting the values of who we are as Americans, but also being practical and cognizant of the fact that we live in a very dangerous world. And the world we're living in, and this has come clear to me over the past several months, we're in a new world where terrorism is the war of the future. In a sense, September 11th was the Pearl Harbor of World War III. But it's not a war that's being fought with armies and air forces and bombers. It's largely being fought with intelligence. That's our first line of defense. And I don't want to be the guy that says, well, we don't like collecting this because it makes us uneasy and we think it's a violation of the Fourth Amendment. And then there's a nuclear weapon that's the size of a large suitcase in the hold of a tramp steamer headed for Miami. So we've got to weigh it, and I've been constantly working on that. I approve of the president's recent proposal to get this metadata out of the hands of the government. I've been saying from the very beginning, I don't like the fact that they have this metadata and they tell us, well, we'll get a warrant before we search it. But to me, that's sort of an illusory protection if they've got all the data sitting there and it can be abused. And world history tells us that if governments have a power that they can abuse, ultimately they will. So,
can you explain what
I think we're
– Yeah, sorry to interrupt.
Yeah, metadata is – I'm sorry. Metadata – I shouldn't – you're absolutely right, Keith, to ask that question. Metadata is the term that means these phone call records. And by the way, not content. It's not content, but it's which number called which number and how long the call lasted. So, for example, at the time of the Boston Marathon bombing, they could immediately check the phone number of the guy who was one of the prime suspects and see who he called in the day or weeks or months before to see whether it's a larger plot, to see who he's connected with, to see whether he called people overseas. And that's what that program is all about. And heretofore, that data has been collected and held by the government itself. In other words, all these phone numbers. What the president is proposing is that the data not be in the hands of the government, but be retained by the phone companies, which, you know, they have it anyway. It's their data. And it can only then be searched by the government getting what amounts to a warrant from a court to go in and say, this is a number that we need to search. This is why. And I think that is there may be situations and emergencies where they don't have to go through the warrant process, but they would have to go through it later. Again, what we're trying to do here is balance two important values, the value of security and the value of privacy. And it would be a great world if we didn't have to worry about it. But the framers knew about spies. They, you know, Nathan Hale, we all learned about. And intelligence is part of protecting ourselves. And in this cyber age, it's one that we have to be very careful about it. My view is we have to calibrate it on a constant basis as technology changes and as risks change.
We're going to change topics here and go to Long Island and Penny. Hi, Penny. Welcome to the program.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. Go ahead, please.
Yes. Senator King, I wanted to ask you, given what's happened with the Sinclair trial, would your vote have been any different on the Gillibrand bill if you had known what the outcome of the Sinclair trial was?
No, in fact.
And Senator, if you could explain the premise of the question. A lot of people listening don't know about the Sinclair trial or the Gillibrand. Go ahead.
Yeah. This is the question of sexual assault in the military. And the Armed Services Committee, of which I'm a member, passed the most comprehensive set of changes in how sexual assault is handled in American history this past winter. And then on the floor of the Senate, we adopted Claire McCaskill's amendment recently, which went even further. What we didn't do, and really what the issue came down to, Senator Gillibrand of New York had an amendment which basically would have taken the decision of whether or not to go forward on a sexual assault or any other major crime prosecution. That was one of the problems, by the way, but let's focus on sexual assault. Taken that decision away from the military commander and moved it outside of the of what's called the chain of command to a military lawyer to make that decision. After a great deal of thought, talking to everyone I could find, listening to people in Maine, hearings, we probably spent more time on this issue than any other single issue last year on the Armed Services Committee. I concluded that I thought that would be a mistake for the victims. The only way this problem is going to be solved in the long run is a change of culture within the military. The only way cultures change is through leadership, and I don't want the commander saying, Congress says this is no longer my problem. They took it away from me. They said, I can't be trusted to deal with this, so it's not my problem, and I'm not going to have to attend to it. I felt that would be a step in absolutely the wrong direction. The caller talks about a trial of a general who was allegedly involved in some pretty serious sexual assaults, and they ended up reducing the charges. But I think it's interesting that the reduction of the charges was by the JAG officer, not by the lawyers, by the prosecutor, not by the by the military authority that referred the case to the court martial. So I don't think that case, it's a serious sexual assault case, but I don't think it changes the. If anything, I think it argues the other way. There's a fair amount of data that commanding officers are more likely to prosecute sexual assault cases than the professional prosecutors, because the prosecutors worry about whether, how strong the evidence is and whether the case is winnable and those kinds of things. And I want this responsibility to be with the commanders. And by the way, one of the things that was done was if the commander and the JAG officer disagree, if the commander said this shouldn't go to court martial, the lawyer, the prosecutor says it should, that decision then goes to the civilian secretary of the Army or the Air Force of the service branch. So there are lots of checks and balances. And I can tell you, Claire, there is no stronger advocate against sexual violence in the military than Claire McCaskill, senator from Missouri, former prosecutor. And she was passionate on this subject that it would be a mistake, and I agreed with her.
All right. We're going to take another quick break. When we come back, more of your comments and questions. The number, 1-800-399-3566. Our guest today, Senator Angus King. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Museums as a business can be a curious proposition.
We're not interested in going after the thing that costs a lot of money. We're interested in going after the thing that can make a difference in terms of how we see the past.
I'm Kai Rizdal with the President in Europe and Russia in Crimea, a museum of the Cold War, next time on Marketplace from APM.
Marketplace tonight at 6:30.
From the eve of something that changed everything to the eve of what exactly? 100 years ago in the spring of 1914, what did the world imagine was about to happen? World War I changed everything. A bloody conflict the great powers just wandered into. Where are we wandering today? Echoes and lessons for 2014 from 1914. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
And you can hear The Takeaway this evening at midnight.
Welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, Senator Angus King. We invite you to join the conversation. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. And, Senator, I do want to talk before we end the program here in the next 20 minutes about your experience in the Arctic, but we want to work in a few more calls if we can.
Sure.
And by Arctic, I don't mean northern Maine. To Thomaston and Carmen. Hi, Carmen.
Hello, Dr. King. I'm very glad to be speaking with you. And I want to mention a great concern that I have personally and a number of us have, and it's about the increasing amount of money and private money, undisclosed money in campaign elections. And as you may know, last year in Maine, we did our legislature did pass a resolution to forward what was called a memorial to the United States Congress to pass a constitutional amendment to reverse the ruling of Citizens United. But I want to bring it to something that I just heard about. First, my first question would be, what has been happening in the Senate itself about that, or you personally, how you have responded? And yesterday, though, I was reading about a resolution by Senator Durbin, and he is proposing a Fair Elections Now Act, and this would be specifically for election campaigns for our senators, as you are.
Senator King?
And that was a revision of the Federal Election Campaign Act that goes back to 1971.
Well, I think you've asked one of the most important questions of our time, and I'm glad to hear you, and I hope many others in Maine are becoming aware of this. Something has happened in the last 3 or 4 years in our campaigns that is really unprecedented, and that is this explosion of outside money and how it influences campaigns. It's something I'm deeply engaged in here, and in fact am working on legislation to at least disclose the identities of the people who are giving all this money. I mean, there's this now elaborate structure where people essentially can hide their identities and yet make multimillion-dollar contributions. And we're just in a wash in it. In North Carolina already, and it's still March, something like $8 or $9 million has already been spent against Kay Hagan, the senator from North Carolina, by outside groups. And this is... Right now, the problem, I can tell you, right now is that the Republicans see this as to their advantage because a great deal of this money is coming from people who are sympathetic to them. If the shoe were on the other foot and if they were being the victims of these huge outside expenditures, then I think they would have a different view of this. But it's just fundamentally, to me, it's fundamentally inconsistent with who we are. And as you point out, in order to really limit it, it would probably require a constitutional amendment because the Supreme Court has ruled that money is speech and that corporations are people. And the only way to change a Supreme Court ruling other than a change in the Supreme Court is through a constitutional amendment. In the meantime, though, that's going to take time, and I'm supportive of that. But in the meantime, I think disclosure, at least the people of Maine ought to know who's paying for all this money to tell them that King or Collins is a dope, and I just think that's sort of common sense. You're not allowed to go to a Maine town meeting with a bag over your head. If you're going to talk and make your views known, you know, tell us who you are. And to me, that's the kind of common sense view. So you're absolutely right. It's a huge problem. I like Durbin's approach, Senator Durbin's approach. And if we don't do something about it, it's you know, you talk about the, you know, when you hear about Putin, they talk about the oligarchs, and the oligarchs are running Russia. These are a fairly small number of very rich people. You know, I'd hate to see that said about America, that our politics was turned over to a bunch of oligarchs.
We'll go back to the phones in a moment. But speaking of Russia, you took a trip recently to the Arctic, which had kind of a couple of nuances to this, because you were visiting a Navy base, a submarine operation that breaks through ice and helps the Navy better operate in Arctic conditions, but also sort of touched on this, on climate change, on the melting of ice in the Arctic, the opening of passageways in the Arctic, and what that might mean for shipping, what that might mean for nations who are trying to get a foothold in controlling those shipping pathways, but also this sort of opening, I guess, possibly a new kind of submarine defense needs, if you want to put it that way, protecting us from the Soviets, who are essentially across this block of ice from us. So a lot going on there. What was your takeaway from that visit?
Well, the trip was 36 hours. It was from 7 o'clock Saturday morning till midnight Sunday night. It was an amazing trip out over, flew to Prudhoe Bay and then out over the ice north of the Arctic Circle. The drastic meltback of the ice in the Arctic Ocean is probably one of the clearest manifestations of global climate change, and it's creating both challenges and opportunities. The opportunities are that it's opening up areas for, as you mentioned, ship passage. Remember, we all studied in school, the explorers were looking for the famous Northwest Passage. Well, now it exists. And at certain months of the year, you can now go through the Bering Strait and through the Arctic Ocean and down by Greenland and into the Atlantic Ocean. So it creates commercial opportunities. There's a lot of energy stored up there in terms of oil and gas. But there's also possibilities of confrontation. Russia is there are only four or five countries that border the Arctic Ocean. Russia is one, the U.S. via Alaska, Canada, Greenland, and Scandinavia. And so it's an area where there is potential conflict and potential opportunity. You asked what my greatest conclusion after this trip and spending a day on the submarine and the night. My greatest conclusion was what an amazing group of young people we have working for us in the United States Navy. Extraordinary people that are capable, proud, patriotic, working under difficult circumstances. And that was number one. Number two, these submarines are pretty amazing devices that can make their own water, make their own air. They don't have to be refueled for years. And they're very potent part of our defense structure. So, you know, I'm on the Armed Services Committee, I'm on the Intelligence Committee, and I have found in my experience there's no substitute for seeing for yourself. You know, and you authorize purchasing submarines and you authorize staffing and making those kinds of decisions here in Washington. It really helps. And the taxpayers, these things are expensive for sure, but one thing I noticed was this submarine is very Spartan, very close quarters, no fancy woodwork in the officer's mess or anything like that, very businesslike, but an amazing piece of technology. And in fact, we were there. I just was on the floor talking to Senator Murkowski of Alaska, who was going on a similar trip this coming weekend, which has been canceled because while we were there, the ice started to break up around the camp. The scientific research camp, and they had to dismantle it two or three weeks early. So we don't know whether this is going to be another one of those serious meltback years, but the ice in the Arctic Ocean has receded something like 40% in the last 25 years.
Well, people listening,
it's
will
an amazing phenomenon.
Sure, and people listening to this will appreciate the sort of pragmatic implications of that in terms of submarine defense and shipways are going to ask the question, well, what about climate change and what's the U.S., in particular the U.S. Congress, doing to address
well,
this?
Well, Keith, that's one of my most frustrating things down here because this is science, and it shouldn't be a political issue. I made a speech on the floor a couple of weeks ago. In fact, a bunch of us stayed up all night and did an all-night series of speeches on climate change just to try to dramatize this question. And I said, look— you know, the speed of light is 186,000 miles a second. That's not a partisan issue. Why, you know, this is science. Why are we debating this? And I talked about the historic fact in Maine that the sort of godparents of the environmental movement in Maine were virtually all Republicans. I remember it from the 70s. People like Harry Richardson and Dave Huber and Sherry Huber Hottie Hildreth. I mean, those were all Republicans. Somehow this has become a partisan issue, and it shouldn't be. I believe what's going to happen is the science is going to become so overwhelming that we just can't resist it. And I think there were 29 senators. That's a pretty significant number who participated in this all-night session. And I don't know whether it's going to take some real shock, some climate shock, or whether it's going to be just to the accumulation of the scientific evidence. But the solving it won't be easy. But recognizing the problem and quitting denying the problem is the beginning of wisdom in this case, I think.
Got about 5 minutes left. We'll try to work in as much as we can here to Belfast and Catherine. Hi, Catherine. Real briefly, if you can, please.
Good afternoon. I want to follow up with what the senator said about being careful who we get involved with.
This is with respect to Ukraine, you mean?
With Ukraine, yes. Exactly. Victoria Nuland said in a publicly disclosed telephone call with the American ambassador in Ukraine that we've spent $5 billion trying to midwife this thing. And what she meant by that was that she was making a selection of who would take over once they got rid of the legally elected president of Ukraine, the guy named Yatsenyuk, Fatherland Party. Then you have a person named Mr. Yarush, who's a former...
Yeah, Catherine, I'm sorry to move you along here, but again, there's only a few minutes left. What's your question, please?
If we want to be careful who we're associating with. We're associating with a lot of past pro-Nazi people and people who are smashing people in the head because they're Russian. And I want to know, what are your sources about who these people are?
Okay. Senator?
Well, I'm not familiar with the article or the call that you mentioned, but certainly I think you raise a valid point, and we have to be careful. And you'd think we would have learned this by now, that when you break things, you don't know what the consequences are going to be, and they can end up being as serious or more serious than where you started. So I think we've got to be very careful about not taking sides and being careful who we are associating with in the Ukraine. It's a very, very volatile situation. On the other hand, the best thing that can happen that we can do is to try to support the legally elected parliament, which is still in place, and help them to try to stabilize the country and not invite Soviet incursion.
All right, let's go to Hope and Michael. Hi, Michael.
How are you doing, Senator?
Good, thanks.
I realize I said Soviet. I should have said Russian. I'm still thinking in the 80s. Go ahead, Michael.
And Michael, keep your question to 30 seconds, if you could.
Yeah, 30 seconds. The low-level radiation dump in New Mexico has blown up and spreading nuclear waste, and I haven't found any more information if it's still blowing nuclear waste. I'm also worried about the veterans who served on the aircraft carrier who got irradiated when Fukushima went up. And I'd like to know if we can get any more information on really what's happening, because the Japanese government has basically put a gag order on anybody or any information coming out about the reactors.
Okay, thank you, Mike.
Well, we ought to you're right. The Japanese government and the Japanese utility have not been very forthcoming. And I think to the extent that we've been put our people at risk in trying to help them with that terrible problem, we ought to be able to hold those folks accountable. I think that's something that should be taken up at the highest level. I agree with you. And also what's going on in New Mexico, it just underlines the fact that these are dangerous instrumentalities, and we have to be very careful.
We don't have time to take Ian's call in Ellsworth, but he's asking, what is your stance on net neutrality in the last minute here?
I'm all for it. I can answer. That's an easy one. I'm for it all the way. I think that's and I think that's something we have to pay some attention to. And I am worried about it in terms of sort of where some of the carriers are going. So net neutrality, I think, is a very important issue.
And this refers to this idea of charging more for higher kind of standards of access.
Right. It would be the your internet carrier saying we're gonna have a deal with Netflix that they pay less than Joe Doakes's website. And being able to discriminate between websites, and I don't think that should be the case. I think the internet ought to be absolutely open and free, and not subject to carriers charging differential tolls.
And Senator King, finally, in the interest of our main calling book club program tomorrow, someone wants to know what you're reading, what you'd recommend right now.
I'm in the middle of a couple of books. One is an absolutely unbelievable book called My Beloved Land by a guy named Ari Shavit about the history of Israel, which is just riveting and very well written. I am finishing The Guns of August, as I mentioned. I'm in the middle of a great book called Gettysburg by a professor at Gettysburg College, Gettysburg, The Last Invasion. And for fun, I'm reading Boone's Lick by Larry McMurtry. So that's I read books pieces at a time.
Yeah. It's quite a stack you got there on your nightstand. Senator King, thanks so much for joining us today.
Hey, great to be with you, Keith. Sorry to have been late.
No trouble. We enjoyed talking to Kay. Angus King, the junior senator serving the state of Maine. Today's program produced by Jonathan Smith. Our volunteer, Lucas Randall Owens, answered your calls. John Keimel ran the board, and we had help from the MPBN web team. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as a link to our podcast, by visiting mpbn.net/Maine Calling. You can also find our podcast on iTunes. Tomorrow on the program, join host Jennifer Rooks, as mentioned, for the next installation of the Maine Calling Book Club. Jennifer and her panelists will be discussing When We Were the Kennedys by Monica Wood. We invite you to share your thoughts about the book on the Maine Calling Facebook page or by emailing mainecallingbookclub@mpbn.net. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on the Maine Public Broadcasting Network.